Hello, everyone. Thank you for being with us today. I'm your host, Pamela Birdman. This is the fourth webinar in a series called Quantitative Leap, where we've been exploring how math policies can strengthen the transition between high school and college. Thank you for joining us. And also thank you to our two sponsors, Opportunity Institute here in Berkeley, which promotes educational opportunity and equity, and also LearningWorks nearby in Oakland, which aims to strengthen student achievement in community colleges. And we're very grateful for the support for these webinars from the James Irvine and the College Futures Foundations. The important reason for these webinars is our shared concern about the large numbers of students not being college ready in mathematics. This is a national issue, and it is definitely a California issue, as you can see from the next slide. In California, about 85% of incoming students, according to some estimates, are not transfer ready in math. And at the CSU system, about a third of admitted high school graduates are below the proficient level. And even at the University of California, some campuses have students who require remedial math courses. Altogether, we're talking about roughly 250,000 students. So this is something that many of us are concerned about. These webinars are structured around a policy brief that I wrote and LearningWorks published. Thank you again, LearningWorks. They're structured around three hurdles for addressing math readiness. First, the need for a better and clearer definition of readiness that's more consistent across segments from K-12 to university and better reflects the mathematics that students need to know and do in college and beyond. Secondly, a need for more effective ways of assessing students' readiness and then placing them into classes most appropriate for them and relevant to their studies. And thirdly, the importance of improving how students are prepared in the K-12 system so they're more likely to be ready for their college math courses. And these strategies go hand in hand, but in the webinars, we've been looking at them, you know, one at a time. Here you see what we covered in the first three webinars, and I want to call your attention in particular to webinar 3, where we were trying to unpack the links between high school course taking and math readiness, and we focused in then on the math courses students take in their senior year. We also discussed the fact that in California, the Cal State system currently requires 3 years of math in high school for admission, but is considering a proposal to require 4 years, which would mean all students admitted to Cal State would have taken math in their senior year. So today we are building on that discussion to look more specifically at what's called senior year transition math courses. So this is one area in my policy brief that I recommended needs to be looked at in terms of preparation. And this idea of senior year transition courses really brings, ideally, in concept, it's supposed to bring together the K-12 and higher education systems to make that transition more effective. I'm very happy to be hosting this conversation here in usually sunny California, since our own Cal State University actually pioneered this idea of senior year transition courses, and they did this in English. So the senior year transition courses are designed to help students become college ready. In California, they are based on students' scores on their 11th grade standards test, which is now the Smarter Balance test, and they target students who don't appear to be on track to be college ready in a year, but they're also not too far off, and these students are called conditionally ready. Students in this category can use a course called the ERWC, Expository Reading and Writing course, which we're going to hear more about later, to become college ready. Now, at this point, multiple states have developed transition courses in English as well as in math. The important thing about these courses is that they have an avenue for students to become college ready or exempt from developmental education. In the case of ERWC, that avenue is the course itself, but in some other models that we're going to hear about, students must still take a placement test or some other standardized test. One reason we're particularly interested in these math readiness courses is because the state has identified them as a priority and is investing about $6 million of, it's actually federal money, into a challenge that they put out for regions to develop new math transition courses. So we're really excited to see what comes of that investment from the state. And in our webinar today, we're hoping to learn more about the evidence around these transition courses to date in English and math, and really consider the implications for improving student success and equity in mathematics. To help us do that, I'm very pleased to introduce our four guests. First, we're first going to hear from Neil Finkelstein. Neil is a senior research scientist at WestEd. Neil led an evaluation of the ERWC course, but what's great for us is he also does considerable research on math readiness. So he's going to walk us through some of the evidence on ERWC and try to tie that together with what we know about math to just talk about the implications for transition courses in math. Okay, then we're going to go out to a national perspective. We're going to hear from Elizabeth Barnett from Community College Research Center. Elizabeth has been looking at these senior year transition courses for a few years and has written several reports with some colleagues looking at various states, and she's going to share some of her findings focusing on West Virginia and the CUNY system. Then we're going to move to Tennessee, where Angela Boatman is an assistant professor at Vanderbilt University, who's been researching Tennessee's senior year math transition courses and has some interesting findings on that to share. And then we're going to come back to California, where we're going to hear from Pitt Turner, who is one of the instructors at Sierra College who is involved with a senior year math transition course in the Sacramento region. And he's going to talk to us about that, and I'm pleased to share. We did not know this when we scheduled Pitt, but since we scheduled this webinar, Sierra and their partners have actually been awarded one of the state grants we talked about. So this will be a course to keep an eye on, and we'll probably hear more from Pitt in the future. But for now, we're going to hear from Neil Finkelstein. Neil,
thank you, Pam.
You're up.
Thank you, Pam. Really wonderful of you and your colleagues to organize this, and very happy to participate. As you suggested, what I'm going to do in my segment here is try to make the connections between what we know from studying the expository reading and writing course and of course, the transitions to math in the senior year. And I'm looking for my little prompt to advance slides, and that little icon is hiding a bit, so let's see if we can find it.
If you click on the slide, there you go.
There we go. So the expository reading and writing course is, as Pam said, it's a 12th grade English course, and that's important because it's meeting the A to G requirements. So students are required to have 4 years of English as part of their requirements. For those who might be dialing in from out of California, of course, these are the college readiness courses that both the University of California and the California State University system have endorsed as a portfolio of courses in sequence in standard areas of the academic program. And we'll come back to this in several different ways this afternoon. 4 years of English are required, and of course this ERWC expository course meets one of those for the seniors requirement in English. It's aligned with standards. The developers of this course spent a lot of time making sure that it was not only standards aligned historically, but also massive and major revisions and updates to make sure that it's aligned as the Common Core state standards were introduced that were later then adopted by California. A long history here, more than 20 years of development by the California State University team and the Center on Reading at the California State University Sacramento. That's very knowledgeable and experienced curriculum designer and provider, and a whole infrastructure in the state by which teachers are allowed to participate in an elaborate system of supports and training programs delivered by county offices of education and other collaborators to certify teachers who'd like to become fluent and uphold the structure and the design of the expository reading and writing course. In that sense, there's a note to make here about the duration in which this course has been offered over time and why that's important as we think about developing systems in math. The course why we're here is that we're trying to, as Pam suggested, find opportunities for students to move smoothly and efficiently through their sequence without the need for developmental education support. We know that those students, in most terms, really struggle through these developmental education sequences, and if we can find a way to allow students access into courses in their post-secondary experience without the need for developmental education support, that would bode well for their progression and accomplishing degrees, both bachelor's degrees and associate's degrees in the community college system. And of course, this takes us to the policy discussion where in 2016-2017, the California budget now asks the question, can there be a math transition course that would support students the way we do in English? And in the governor's budget at the time, the writing was very persuasive. It said, we have a long, rich history of a writing and reading course in the English language arts sequence in California. And what could we do in math that would mirror it? How would we test this? How would we design this? And we'd like to include some dollars for the California State University and others to explore this. Of course, we're trying to mitigate remediation rates. We want to make sure that that's always the focus. So we're going to talk about this today in a couple of different ways, and I just want to highlight this middle bullet on the page, which is that in our policy discussion, as we noted, what does it mean to have 4 years of a course sequence, as we require in English, versus 3 years of a course sequence in math? And this will come around in many different ways, but of course, as we think about the design requirements for math, we're very eager to have students take a fourth year, and yet want to point out that in current policy, it's not required in order to meet the A to G portfolio. Now that's particularly important, and you'll see in this bottom of this third bullet on your screen, I use the word rusty, and we've seen in really a large number of studies that one of the challenges in math proficiency and demonstrating math proficiency is that when students stop taking math as of the end of their junior year in high school, and then wait a year or maybe even longer to become part of a post-secondary entry admission sequence, they simply haven't been in practice. And so we find many students being underprepared for those placement tests in mathematics, and it is something that's a very, very important point here. What does it mean to work on smooth sequences that help students stay fluent, and how are English and math different in that way? Both content and the support that's needed to keep you proficient. Just very briefly to go through some of the findings from the expository reading and writing course evaluation. It was supported by the U.S. Department of Education as an investing and innovation grant. We were very fortunate to have partnership from the Fresno County Office of Education in the Central Valley in California, which is a long-term provider of expository reading and writing course support staff. And of course, our colleagues at the California State University and our colleagues at WestEd. My really close collaborator, Tony Fong, is the lead author on the study, and that can be found on the WestEd.org website for folks who want to look at the report and find out some of the really important details around implementation. We followed students for a couple of years, and we used something called the English Placement Test as an outcome measure for the study. That is, we asked students who had and had not participated in the expository reading and writing course who were compared systematically in a quasi-experimental study to take this test at the end of their senior year, and we looked at the difference between them. We were just as interested in the implementation data as we were in anything, and we'll talk about that in just a second. There were 9 California school districts, 24 high schools. We had 56 teachers who were teaching the course and 58 who weren't. We had just over 5,000 students in the data. You can see from the slide about 3,300 were in the expository reading and writing course and 1,900 took a different course, and that's the basis for the comparison that's so helpful. I want to thank all the schools and teachers and students who participated. As I noted, we were able to come up with a matched design structure, which is a design that's a relatively rigorous design. We talk about them as quasi-experimental studies. It's one stop short of a randomized trial, but nevertheless, by research standards, really very, very good quality in order to make an inferential statement about the effects of any kind of intervention, in this case, looking at how well students did on their English placement test. You can see that we had some information about students, who they were, what courses they had taken in the past, how they had done in those courses, and at the time, the California Standards Test in grade 11 was a piece of information that was useful in being able to match those students who had and had not taken the course. We found that students did score slightly higher on the placement test compared to those students who had enrolled in other English courses. So the group that was given the expository reading and writing course did a little bit better. The results were statistically significant. And so we make the statement that this positive effect on student achievement didn't happen by chance. And for the researchers in the group, it was 13 one-hundredths of a standard deviation, which is an effect size that's reasonable to think is of useful and practical applicability in education settings. Now, a lot of this has to do with the fidelity with which a course is offered, and this comes up a lot as we think about math designs as well. Simply, what is the course? How do you break it down? Is it implemented systematically? How much variation and autonomy would we recommend to teachers as they work through the course? And these are the many, many different considerations that we need to think about as we design math courses. Are we trying to come up with one or two or a portfolio of courses? Do they have common components? Do they have common modules? How closely aligned are the content modules to the requirements in different kinds of course content work that have been affirmed by our faculty senates and by our leaders in higher education systems around what students need to know and in different areas? And you can see that we had a particular set of definitions that needed to be followed. And we're looking for teachers having to teach between 8 and 10 modules at a level that we thought was high. 17.9% of the studies teachers did teach at least 8 of those modules. And now I'll show you that it's really quite an interesting dynamic about how and who teaches which modules and whether that matters. Bear with me as I just wait for the prompt to reappear on my screen. Sometimes there's just an ever so slight delay. But what you'll see in just a minute is that there's a variation in the number of activities that are completed in reading rhetorically and connecting reading to writing and writing rhetorically. Now, I have to say, for those of you who think that the color blue has turned into red, I'm showing a green, yellow, and red line on my screen. A green for the skills of reading rhetorically, yellow for connecting reading to writing, and blue, in this case red on my graph, for writing. But nevertheless, you can see that these waver between the percent of activities that were completed frequently, up at 90%, all the way down to some of those that were completed with 50% at the far right of your screen. That's important because in any course that's designed, we're ultimately looking for the question of scale. And in the expository and reading and writing course, we have a system set up that allows teachers to kind of know the rules and to, by the process of working on implementation feedback systems and us using coaching logs and professional norms around their work, we do have a way of not only explaining what's expected, but of following it and tracking it into the future. So those are some of the things that will undoubtedly come up in our discussions through this morning on what's required. Engagement matters. That's what we think about for both teachers and students, the ability of students to think critically, the way in which writing improved. And then, of course, you can see challenges, varying ability within the classroom, looking for differential instructional strategies by teachers, and, of course, the pace that was required by teachers to get through these. This is some of the comments that we heard from teachers during the implementation. So to wrap up, we found in the expository reading and writing course that early intervention is better, and that's certainly going to hold true as we think about math. The way that the placement structure is organized is critical, and in this particular example, as Pam signaled, simply taking the expository reading and writing course and passing the course was a promise to students that they could be placed in a credit-bearing entry-level course once they got to the California State University, and that's an enormous incentive to students. Now, as well, there are other ways to place into those courses based on placement exams, but simply taking the courses is a big deal. And you might imagine in your own mind somewhat of a tree diagram in the decision of designers, whether or not it's the course that should give students the access into a credit-bearing math course, or it's placement testing, or a combination, or a multiple measure system. And I hope our other presenters will talk to this point. And finally, I just want to reiterate this at this point about how much 4 years matters and what it means to have a continuous sequence in math all the way through your senior year in high school. So let me stop there, and I'll be on the line throughout the call and can certainly answer questions with the rest of the group. Thank you for your time this morning.
Hi, everyone. I'm glad Neil mentioned questions. Please know you can send your questions in at any point using the chat function on the webinar control panel. If they're for a particular speaker, please note that. And we will be doing questions at the end after all four speakers. So thank you, Neil. That was one model of senior year transition course, and it was also one type of research design. Now we're going to hear about different models of courses and different research designs. We're going to go to Elizabeth Barnett now.
Well, thank you, Pam, and greetings from wet, cold New York. I'm going to talk this afternoon a little bit about our research, highlighting a couple of studies we did on the impact of high school transition courses on short-term college outcomes. Our research was conducted under what's turned out to be a four-year project, intended to be a three-year project, funded by the Gates Foundation, called Reshaping the College Transition. And we were interested in, first of all, college readiness assessments. So any assessments that might be administered to students during the 11th grade that would show their readiness to, or their the extent to which they were on track to be ready to perform college level work. And then secondly, what we call transition curricula. So courses, learning modules, or online tutorials developed jointly by secondary and post-secondary faculty and offered no later than 12th grade to students at risk of being placed into remedial math or English. In practical terms, we focus mainly on actual courses offered during the senior year. So the potential of early college readiness assessments, just knowing whether you're on track to being college ready, can produce an impact and can allow students and schools to take action to make sure that students do become college ready. And a study was done on this of the California EAP, and it was found that just participation in this assessment was offering students was resulting in students being more prepared in English and in math. So that was a very interesting finding in itself. And as far as transition courses go, the theory is that, you can use the senior year of high school more effectively. You can offer courses at no extra cost, although in some cases we did see that some extra costs were involved. You can offer students high school credit, so it becomes, it's taken seriously as an actual high school course. It can be aligned with colleges' criteria for college readiness as determined and measured by the college. And as Neil mentioned, it sometimes includes a mechanism for actually placing out a developmental education, although not always. And when we started this study, we were seeing that there were some initial descriptive results that were indicating that this approach had promise. And more recently, there are more rigorous research results, such as the ones being described on this webinar. I should mention that what we did first was just to look at what was out there. We did a 50-state scan. This was 12 years ago, and at that point, there were about half of states had some kind of system for early college readiness assessment that was done at the state level, and then there were 13 states where there were local efforts of some kind. And there were only 8 states in which transition courses were being systematically offered. And, you know, we know that that's growing since then, and we are planning to do further research to understand better the extent to which this is spread and the different types of courses being offered. Then we did some research in 4 states, California, Tennessee, and we'll be hearing about those from other people. And we also did work in West Virginia and New York. Our first work was to look at different policies, approaches, and implementation styles, and then, you know, we got into looking at impact. So that's what I'm going to share more about here today. So in West Virginia, a course had been offered. It was developed by high school and college faculty together, working at the state level, and it was implemented statewide beginning in 2011-12. And I should note that the course that was developed was replaced, I guess it was essentially 3 years later, and the course that they're now implementing is one based on the SREB, the Southern Region Education Board curriculum, that people may want to take a look at. They're called Math Ready and Literacy Ready courses. Students were eligible for this course if they scored below a specified level on the 11th grade state test. It was considered to be essentially a review of high school mathematics. The Teach 21 website offered a number of resources for teachers, and there were also some face-to-face professional development offered. And at the end of the course, the students would take the Compass exam. And the overall goal of the course was to have students prepared to pass that Compass exam and be college ready, although much of the course was based on other kinds of materials, such as ACT preparation materials. We conducted a research design called regression discontinuity, which basically takes advantage of the fact that, you know, students are placed using a particular cut score, and it looks at students who place right above and below that cut score and compares them. The understanding is that because testing instruments are not very, very precise, that the students right below and right above would be essentially similar. So this is considered to be a rigorous design. We looked at math readiness on college entry and passing gatekeeper courses, meaning first college level courses in math, as our primary outcomes. And then we also looked at several other outcomes on that we considered secondary. And what we found was quite disappointing, that essentially what we found is that for the most part, or pretty much across the board, outcomes were less positive for students who participated in these transition math courses than for students who were in other math courses. And I should mention that students were required to take 4 years of math, so any student who wasn't in a transition math course was in some other math course. And I should also mention that those math courses had been around longer than the transition course, so, you know, may have been more established and you know, with teachers who are experienced at teaching them. So what we see is that with regard to passing a gatekeeper course or first college level course within a year, students in the transition math course were 5 percentage points less likely to pass that gatekeeper course. They were also less likely to enroll within college in 1 year, and they earned fewer college level credits. So that was, you know, a somewhat sobering finding, and we think that there are a couple of different possible explanations. One, as I mentioned, you know, the alternative courses that they were taking may well have been better, and they may have, you know, given students an opportunity to be with more prepared peers. But the two other possible explanations that we consider is, one, that the course may not have been particularly well aligned with the Compass test. And since that was essentially the measure of success, that would, is what would permit students to go into the Gatekeeper course and earn college level credits. That may have been an issue. The other possibility is that students, in being placed into the course, were informed that they were not college ready, and just that messaging alone may be something that has an impact. So even with those findings, you know, I certainly am not ready to give up on transition courses. And in fact, we did find that the ones that we studied in New York City had a modestly positive impact. So in New York City, the at-home and college program is one that's been administered by the City University of New York in New York City schools to with schools that volunteer to participate. There was staggered implementation beginning in 2008-09 that allowed us to conduct a kind of modified difference in differences design. It targeted students in certain ranges on the region's test scores. So the region's exams are the ones that New York State uses for accountability purposes. So within a band of essentially almost college ready in either English or math, students were eligible to participate. I should note that those guidelines were very loosely followed, but you know, that was the intent, and you know, they were followed to a certain extent. So students then would participate in the subject-specific course, and there was a college knowledge component included that was generally a once-a-week push-in by a counselor who would teach students about the whole process of applying to college. Students took the Compass test, and you know, the goal was both to help them to achieve college readiness and to be able to become more confident in applying to and matriculating to college. So the outcomes that we were looking at were pretty much the same: college readiness at entry into college, or and then passing a Gatekeeper course in math or English. So the results in math were positive, although modest. So for students that participated, they were 1 percentage point more likely to complete a Gatekeeper course in math within 1 year, and they were somewhat more likely to earn college-level credits in math, 1.2 credits. Those were the two statistically significant findings. And just for comparison purposes, I'll also share the English findings, where we actually found that students were slightly less likely to be college ready upon entry into college, but like with the math students, they were more likely to have accrued at least a college credit or closer to a college credit and a half by the end of the first year. So in this case, you know, a couple of points. The students were more likely to be getting the message that they were on track to go to college. Partly by the way they were selected and partly because of this extra college knowledge component. And I should just mention that the math courses were quite aligned with the Compass test, and that may have made a difference there. The English courses were using a lot of materials from psychology and sociology in college as a way of providing students with more exposure. And just to some final thoughts, one thing that we observed through our implementation research is that there are students with many, many different needs below the college readiness cutoff. And I think that's a point that Neil made as well. So that's something that can be challenging for teachers as they're thinking about how to best structure these courses. They're also informed by diverse views of college readiness. So at a number of courses that we encountered were very explicitly focused on helping students to pass a placement test, while others had a broader definition of college readiness, you know, including such things as critical thinking and being able to formulate a good argument. And there were sometimes some tensions between those two views of college readiness. We also found that the actual involvement by K-12 in higher education varied a lot in different locations. Sometimes the college sector, the higher post-secondary education was involved just in initial setup of courses, and in other places they were quite engaged and involved in implementation as well. And then finally, students may or may not actually place out of developmental education as a result of participating in the course. And where those mechanisms weren't present, there seemed to be a greater likelihood that students would actually end up having to retake placement tests and end up in developmental education. So, you know, we continue to be very, very committed to the idea that the senior year of high school should be used for the purposes of making sure students are college ready, and we continue to look for ways to pursue, you know, further research in this area. So look forward to further conversation and any questions you may have.
Well, thanks, Elizabeth. We are going to move on now to Tennessee, where Angela Boatman has been looking at another version of a senior year math transition course and has some preliminary findings to share with us.
Great, thank you. I think this is sort of, in many ways, perfect following Neil and Elizabeth's comments. I think there are some important similarities between the research that both of them have done, but then also some key differences in the programs that we've studied. So I'm going to try to highlight some of those today. I'm talking about today an ongoing statewide research project that's looking at a senior year math transition course in Tennessee. I'm at Vanderbilt University, but this is an evaluation that's joint with the Center for Ed Policy Research at Harvard University, and we're partnering with the Tennessee Department of Ed, the Tennessee Higher Ed Commission, and the Tennessee Governor's Office to ask some questions about the effectiveness of this really pretty large-scale transition program in Tennessee. And the program is called SAILS. It stands for Seamless Alignment and Integrated Learning Support. But just for a little bit of context in the state, this program is one of three pillars of Governor Bill Haslam's Drive to 55 campaign, which is a suite of programs designed to achieve 55% of adults in the state with a post-secondary credential by 2025. So you've likely heard of the Tennessee Promise, which is really one of the largest programs in the state right now in terms of resources and outreach for students. But this is the 2 years of tuition-free college for graduating high school seniors. Tennessee Reconnect is another version of this program for working adults. And then what I'm going to talk about today is the SAILS program. This is a transition course that's offered in the 12th grade year of high school that's designed to address remedial needs to students prior to college entry. So you can see here a little bit about the population of students in the public college system in the state of Tennessee. And SAILS really was born in 2012 to address this issue that about two-thirds of incoming freshmen at the two-year colleges were requiring remediation in at least one subject. The largest of those subjects was math. And the program was developed and created to address the remedial needs prior to students enrolling in college. So what this is it's a computer-based, self-paced math curriculum offered to 12th graders as part of their high school graduation requirement. So a key component of this program was that it was implemented right at the same time that the state moved to requiring 4 years of high school math. So it left many districts in the state and the sort of Tennessee Department of Education thinking critically about what they should require in the fourth year, in the senior year of high school. And they decided to start to roll out at a pretty rapid pace the SAILS program. So what the program is it's actually the identical course as the learning support or the developmental education math course that was being taught in the community colleges. Because that course is computer assisted or computer based, they basically took all of the software, it's a Pearson product, it has been a Pearson product to date, and they moved that into the 12th grade year, into the high school courses. And so students were able to complete the exact same course that they would otherwise have taken once they got to college. They could now complete this in their senior year of high school. SAILS is based on five modules, all of which align with the community college math competencies, and students have to move through these modules in order before completing the course. But when a student, the key piece to this that is slightly different than the programs that Elizabeth was describing, is when a student completes all five of the modules successfully in their senior year of high school, they are automatically exempted from remedial math courses at any public college in Tennessee. So it's structurally designed such that if a student completes it in high school, they do not have to enroll in remedial courses in college. In fact, even in high school, they can go on and enroll in a dual enrollment course in their last semester of high school, even. And we do in separate work, we're looking a bit at the impacts of the dual enrollment program. So just so you can kind of visualize how this works, so the student takes the ACT in 11th grade. The ACT is the instrument used to assign students to remedial courses. If they score below a 19 on the math test prior to the sales program or in schools that do not have the sales program, the student then takes a senior year math course. It's called Bridge Math, and it's not directly aligned with their remedial needs. It's just their fourth year math course. That then would mean that once the student goes to college, the student needs to complete their remedial math requirement, and then they are able to move on to their college-bearing math course. So under the sales pathway, a student takes sales math in their senior year of high school, and as a result of that, they complete their remediation requirements, and they are able to enroll directly in college coursework upon college enrollment. So the study that we're conducting here, it's similar to Neil's in the sense that it's multi-component. We have multiple pieces to this research study. I'm going to mention all five and talk just a bit about the last one today, but it's part of a larger set of questions we're asking about this program. So the first is on implementation. What are the factors and conditions associated with this program being successfully implemented? I'll mention the rapid scale-up of this in a moment. So there are other states looking to Tennessee with questions about how this can be done successfully at such a large scale. The second is that we've surveyed students participating in the sales courses as well as in the traditional bridge math, the 12th grade math course, to try to discern if there are differences in the experiences or attitudes about either high school or college, math, aspirations after high school, when we compare sales and non-sales students. So we try to get some data from the students themselves. And then we also surveyed teachers across 12th grade math courses in the state, and we're looking for differences in how teachers see their practices, beliefs, or experiences using this computer-based course versus their traditional math courses, trying to tease out a bit about how teacher behavior might have changed as a result of the adoption of this program. The fourth area we're looking at, which I think is pretty novel and exciting, is we're looking at the growth in student math achievement. So we're interested in whether the idea that we simply can eliminate the barrier to college level courses by getting students through a sales course and automatically sending them into college level, if that it might be driving any effects that we see, or if it's in part explained by students learning more math in their senior year of high school, and that as simply a product of learning more math, they're able to be more successful once they get into college. So we're trying to tease out this question of like structural barrier versus actual math content knowledge. And so to do this, we are administering the same ACT test at the end of the senior year. So the same test that was used for placement, we're re-administering it at the end of the year to just see if student scores have changed as a result of their senior year math course. And then we will be conducting a regression discontinuity design, which was mentioned by Elizabeth earlier. So we just finished testing those students in the spring of 2016. So we are getting this data back from ACT now and starting to look at some of that. And then finally, we are able to look at prior cohorts of sales students since the program started in 2012. And we can say a bit about how those students are now faring in college. So are they, if we try to find comparable students in the state to sales students, can we say anything about the effects of that program on some of the more short-term college outcomes? Let's see. I seem to have lost my slides.
We're troubleshooting. We'll get the slides back up in 1 minute. You can just tell us what we would be seeing on the slide.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay.
No problem at all. So I was just going to mention that I sort of alluded to the fact that the program scaled up relatively quickly. So it began in 2012 at only 18 high schools, and by the most recent academic year, it was in 239 high schools in the state. That's out of about 300. So So it's nearly full coverage across the state now, and that's in only about 3 years' time. So the program scaled up fairly rapidly, and it actually, the way in which it scaled up creates a nice opportunity for us to study the impact of this program, because we have students in the state that were eligible for the program but not able to enroll given the high school they attended not offering it or not having enough computers for everyone. So we do have some variation here that we're able to exploit. But as a result, there are students, like I just said, who are below the eligibility cutoff, the ones who would be eligible to enroll in sales, who are not able to enroll because of capacity issues. And so we do see below 19 on the ACT, many students in the state are not enrolled in sales, but that's again just as a result of the rollout of the program. And so what we're interested in doing, and Neil alluded to this earlier, is trying to find an adequate comparison group for sales students. Some of our qualitative work has revealed that, you know, the teachers have a lot of say in who's assigned to sales within their schools, and the teachers are not doing that randomly. And so they are thinking about the students and assigning them either to their Bridge Math course, which again does not fulfill their developmental ed requirement, or a sales course, which does. And so we see a lot of, let me skip ahead here to this picture, to this graph. So what we're trying to do is find comparison groups for sales and non-sales students. So this picture, this table, compares sales and non-sales students all with scores below a 19. And descriptively, it looks like students are fairly similar, but this table doesn't perfectly show, but we do see from interviews with teachers and discussions at schools that we know there's some selection going on into who gets placed into sales. So it doesn't make complete sense for us to just flat out compare sales students to non-sales students, because we know there's some selection going on at the school level. And so our challenge then becomes how to find an adequate comparison group. You can see here, if we just descriptively look at the outcomes, it does look like sales students enroll in college at higher rates, particularly in two-year colleges. And they also, as a result structurally of the program, they enroll in remedial math at lower rates and in college math at higher rates than their non-sales peers. Again, we worry about some selection going on here. So similar to what Neil did with the ERWC evaluation, one of the ways we're tackling this, and again, it's ongoing work, so it's sort of a bit of a preview here, but we're tackling this using a weighting or a matching procedure, similar to what they did in California, where we have descriptive observables on these students, and we're using everything we have to try to compare the type of student that gets placed into sales to an observationally similar student who doesn't. And then we're looking at some of the same outcomes Elizabeth has looked at in West Virginia and New York. So graduating from high school, college enrollment, enrolling in college math. Ultimately, we'll be looking at performance in college math. I think that's a pretty important outcome that they looked at in West Virginia. And so we can see here, it actually, from our matching model, it looks like that sales students are performing at higher rates than their non-sales peers when it comes to actually graduating from high school, which I think is pretty interesting, but then also enrolling in college driven largely by two-year colleges. And then structurally, as a result of the program, you see that they are able to enroll in college math in their first year at much higher rates, and we would hope to see that as a design feature of the program. But this is sort of some early impacts that we're seeing here. This is work that we're continuing to expand on as we sort of refine the cohorts. We have a lot of data in the state now, given that this has been going on for 3 years, so we're continuing to further develop this model. So what we have learned so far from this multi-component study is that the program has scaled up in a short amount of time, but it's actually had pretty high fidelity. We've done lots of site visits in the state, and it seems to be relatively evenly administered across many of the high schools in the state. That has a lot to do with a central administration board. The sales students in the survey report being actually very empowered by and comfortable using the computers. They quite like, by and large, have these really positive experiences to the way that they're learning math. And that's in comparison to their peers that are in a more traditional math classroom setting. And then we see these positive impacts on graduation and college enrollment. But then we also see that sales students are more likely to enroll in college level math courses. The big question I think that we're still thinking about is their performance in college level math, and how students do when we are able to compare similar groups of students. And finally, the question that this post-test is going to allow us to answer, which I think is really exciting, is whether the long-term impacts of sales are attributable more to improvements in math achievement or more to a reduction in the barriers of enrolling in college-level math.
Great. Thank you so much, Angela. And sorry for the technical problems, but we're back up here, and we're going to move on to Pitt.
All right. Hi, everybody. My name is Pitt Turner, Sierra College. So we have, for numerous years, been working on a transitional course, high school senior year, and it's kind of based on, let's see if I get this click here. There we go. It's kind of based on a collaboration between every local institute around here. So Sierra College, California State University, all of our feeding high school districts, and the Placer County Office of Education. We all sat down and put this together, which makes it so different. So it's called the ESM, which is an acronym for the Early Assessment Program, Senior Year Math. And the Early Assessment Program, the EAP, that was a CSU's kind of junior year assessment readiness for English and for math. We kind of focused on that as the predictor of what we might be able to do, because the data was basically saying, as everybody knows, that the students are not ready by the time they get to Barossa Community College. And even more importantly is the EAP is a junior year assessment. So if nothing was done their senior year, those stats got worse, which is what we were seeing. The stats said 67% not ready, and we were seeing up into the 80% not ready. That also told us one thing, that if we waited for those students to get to us at the community college, it was probably too late by that point. They would be placed in remediation, and they'd have that roadblock to overcome. And our stats said that if you were placed in remediation, it was very, very low chances for you to make it all the way to graduation, down in the 20%. So we thought, what can we do prior to them getting to us? And that's where we got the high schools together and started talking about a possible senior year. So the course was designed at the idea that students that were deemed not college ready in mathematics could learn and thrive in an environment that fostered and engaged conceptual learning. It used practical, real-life examples and applications. We tried to bring relevance and meaning to the students, and not focus on repeating the algebra, but going beyond that into a more depth approach of the algebra to give them that understanding. So who created the ESM was a partnership. It was a regional partnership held together by MOUs, Memorandums of Understanding, and it had all of, as I said earlier, the major institutes around. The partnership agreement pretty much laid out who was responsible for what, and more importantly, it said that we were going to work together in defining what we thought college ready was, which all institutes had a different idea of where students should be. This MOU got us to the table and said, let's define what we expect a student to have coming out of high school, and what can we do to aid them in getting there. So it kind of ran through a couple years. In first 2009 is when the seed was planted, and we got a small grant to look into some stats. The first couple years was focused on the English, and as Neil was talking about, the ERWC was kind of tied to the EAP. So that first 2 years was us looking at that and trying to convince community colleges around here to accept the ERWC and the EAP as a good way to place a student, a valid assessment and placement tool. After that was looked at, the third and fourth year focused on the math readiness. And the readiness numbers were three levels, now they're four levels, basically saying you're either exceeding standards, you've met standards, you're nearly there, or you haven't met standards. And we focused on the middle three, standards met, but still kind of conditionally ready. and standards nearly met, meaning we did need to give them some boost before they came to the community college. So the conditional ready students is what the course was aimed at, and it was originally non-STEM, but that's kind of developed into something a little bit more. There was a little trial period for 2 years, and that gave us a chance to really refine it because it didn't come easy. We had an after-school program. It was voluntary at first. It really wasn't a part of the curriculum of high school. And after developing it and analyzing it and rewriting it, it was taken into the college or the high school at that time. So it became not just an after-school program. It was based on the Common Core standards, both national and California. We used the curriculum of all the institutes, and we kind of merged it together to, again, try to really align how this course would bring a student who was technically going to be placed in remedial mathematics and ramp them up to the expected level of what we would think an incoming freshman student should have. Basically, they should be able to get into the college level course, so what are we going to do to get them up there? And we found that the content wasn't enough. It had to be designed with a different pedagogy. And so we researched a lot of pedagogy, such as Joe Bowler, Dan Myers, people who are very hands-on and into the depth of the knowledge, not just the formulaic approach. So all those standards kind of guided our curriculum and how to put it together. And it was, again, collaborative. So CSU was on board, community colleges were on board, the local high schools were on board, and it took a while, but everybody finally was able to understand what this could do for us. So in Placer County, where it originated, it was fall 2013, after-school program, 4 sections at 4 high schools. That was the pilot. A little reworking after that, and several grants later, we're at 25 sections in 11 high schools. We've also expanded it into the Sacramento County, and 2014 was their first year piloting it, 3 sections, 3 high schools. But just recently, with the Basic Skills Partnership grant, we were able to push a lot of training for the teachers out there. So now there are 13 sections at 8 high schools. We also just received the California Math Readiness grant, and both of those grants together have given us the funding to expand the program correctly. We can't just let it go out there because it's not the curriculum that's holding this together. It's the collaborative nature and the networking of the teachers, very much like the ERWC. There's a behind-the-scenes network that needs to be there as well, not just the curriculum. So that kind of gets into how it's taught or what the ESM gives. The ESM, that math class, gives to students, to the institutes, and to overall the community several things. For the students, just the understanding, they're given the material so they can dwell on it and have inquiry-based exploration, peer-to-peer learning, and persistence in problem-solving, kind of giving them that grit. But aside from what they learn in the class, when they come to a community college, Sierra College mainly, or to California State University, Sacramento, and Chico, all of them have an agreement that if a student passes this course, that's a good enough assessment to put them into a college-level course. So it's basically waiving the assessment process. And moreover, the student's perspective kind of during the course is not just a high school course, because college professors are also coming in to observe the course and take part, team teach. It's a community of the teachers as well, and students see that. They get to ask questions of the teachers as they're in the classroom, and then you see them on campus when they finally get to Sierra College. I've seen several on campus. They remember me, and it creates a little more than just high school, then community college. It created a community feel. Teachers working together, students have somebody they know when they come to the community college right off the bat. For the institutions, what we found to be really good on this collaborative bit is we're now looking at the high schools, and it's starting to bring the higher ed up to speed on the Common Core. We weren't really talking about it before, but now we are. And this course has got us familiar with the teachers. They've come to our department and given talks about what Common Core is doing, how things are changing. It's kind of brought us a little closer together, as it should be. And I might say that when we started it as an after-school program, it was just FYI. we applied for the G elective, and that gave us G elective, and it was based on the different teaching methodology. But we're now applying for the C status because we recognize that it has more than just what we would think of remedial algebra. It goes beyond that, has those plus signs that we want. So it is already accepted at one high school as C standard. We're now trying to get that across the board for the program to be C standard. And that would give it a really good kind of founding for being able to be accepted at other community colleges or other UCs or CSUs. And the reformatting has to be a part of that, meaning that the course as written has been adapted a couple different times, rewritten. And to get C status, we need to change it a little bit more. And that's a part of this program being like a living document. In Placer County, our student population that we were targeting is not the same population as that in Sacramento County, where we're extending. We were aiming for the conditionally ready students at Placer. But in Sacramento, there's a greater majority of people who are not ready. So we had to rewrite the curriculum to put in a little more scaffolding at the bottom. And that just makes it fit the community that we're aiming it for. So as the program expands, the reformatting of the curriculum will match the communities, and the networking has to be brought in so that they have that support structure that they need. And then just to show some stats, the retention has been better than an average student if our students have taken this math course, the ESM. This is general overall through all classes taken. The success stats is what we're looking at more so. And the success of a student coming out of the ESM program is better than the regular, say, control group. Those would be students coming from the same high school districts into our college first year and did not pick the ESM. And that's one thing that we found really interesting. It's that if you look at just the math statistics, they're doing some odd percentage points better, 2-3 percentage points better than an average student. But if you look at how these students are doing on the bigger picture, they're doing up to almost 10 percentage points better in some semesters. So something is different. It's not just the math they're getting, but a part of the pedagogy is they are working better with other people. They are learning how to pick up and get through obstacles like problem solving. So the success is coming out as, yes, it's getting the students up to par with where we expect them to be at the math level, but it's going beyond that, and it's letting them be a little better in any classes that they take. In numbers are still kind of small. This semester we're expecting upwards to 80 to 100 incoming, next semester. But put it all together, and we have almost 300 run through the program coming straight to Sierra College. CSU is now starting to put together a research group to look at those incoming students. That goes straight to them, and that'll take a semester or two for them to get up. But they have seen that the ESM students coming straight to them who take the ELM, which is the entry-level math assessment tool, do much better than a typical student coming in without a senior year course. So clearly the students are not as rusty, and they've got a little bit more depth of knowledge coming into it. So that's our program, and I look forward to questions.
Great. Thanks, Pitt. And we'll look forward to this program being scaled up so that we could see some more rigorous studies done when there are more students, because I believe your data so far is based on descriptive statistics because your sample is kind of small. Now, we have a little bit of time for some questions. I wanted to pick up from Angela's question number 4 and sort of tie together a few of the questions that are coming in here, because Angela talked about this question, are we seeing students seeming to do better because they're actually learning more math or because we've provided a mechanism for them to be exempted from DevEd? I want to note that our second webinar talked about the limitations of placement testing, but yet right now the main mechanism we have, such as in Neil's research, to see what students are learning are standardized tests. So that kind of confounds us. But I do want to ask our presenters, let me put out two theories for why some of these courses may be looking more successful than others. Okay. One theory is that the success of the program depends on this design feature that we're automatically exempting students who pass these courses and allowing them to go into a college-level math course. And in others, we're not doing that. Another theory is that perhaps some of these courses represent sort of a year of generic test preparation that might be demoralizing, boring, and defeating. And maybe a different curriculum that was suggested that would be more intellectually engaging could be more effective. I'm just interested to hear from our presenters what you think about these, what you think about these two potential theories, and for explaining whether these courses are successful or not. Oh, Angela or Elizabeth, would one of you want to take up the question first?
Well, this is Elizabeth. I'm very excited to hear Angela's results because I think, you know, the study that they're engaged in now gives us an opportunity to start pulling apart some of those pieces. But, you know, I think, you know, you pointed out that the mechanisms we have right now for putting students into college are pretty faulty. So, and that for the most part, they're tending to place students into remedial that probably could succeed in college. So just having more ways to place into college level in itself may be one of the mechanisms that helps here.
Great, thank you. Angela, any thoughts on that? Any additional thoughts?
Well, I don't know that this actually addresses the theory idea, but I think this conversation reminds me a lot of the conversation going on right now across the country regarding co-requisite remediation and the idea that if you just eliminate the remedial barrier, if you call it that, for students, that they go on and be successful. And I think there's some good work and expanding work on the effects of that, especially for students that may have been on the margins of these, you know, arguably not very accurate placement tests in the first place. There's some pretty positive research out there suggesting that doing away with this course or barrier or, you know, whatever we call it is a positive thing. And I think that is lending itself more to theory one, right? That the design feature of just reducing this for students may be what's leading to the success. I don't think we have thought too much about the bigger question of what are the how aligned are these courses with later math college success college courses and how successful students are in those courses. So I'm also very interested in this question of content, math, learning more math, and the role that plays in trying to understand students' later success.
Right. Well, thank you. I want to say that partly why I wanted to ask that question had to do with looking at Neil's and his colleagues' evaluation of ERWC, because I noted that it looked like the ERWC students did perform better on the test instrument than the non-ERWC students, but they were still on average below the cut score that CSU normally uses to place students into college level English on average. So I definitely, you know, wondered if CSU decided that these students still have to take a placement test, if ERWC would look much less successful than it does look. So Neil, I don't know if you have a comment on that. And also, Neil, I wanted to ask if you could say a little bit about your thoughts about how the potential for these courses to address equity issues and by improving outcomes for underrepresented students.
Sure. Thanks, Pam. I think you've raised a good question. There's something that's come up in several of the presentations today, which is about the inherent validity of the assessments that we use and whether they are well aligned or not well aligned or over aligned with the kind of expectations that higher education institution faculty have for incoming math students. we could spend an hour alone just talking about these issues of the alignment. And I guess I would just sort of, add to the other guests today that there appear to be, you know, both affective issues going on here as well as the demonstrations of content knowledge and students' ability to move through these sequences. And I think what that offers is a suggestion to, you know, understand that we follow a rich and long tradition of exploring these placement tests as the mechanism, and yet there's probably a lot of other ways in which we can see how students are doing along the way on how they're engaged in their 12th year of content, how they're doing in math, what kinds of problems they're able to solve, how it sort of affects their other content work and other courses, their on-time graduation status. And it seems to me that we ought to be able to think of a more holistic way to make an assessment about whether or not a student is ready for a credit-bearing course in content areas once they get to their post-secondary institution. That is the equity question, I think. You know, we're of a long tradition of excluding people based on a test to our institutions and to their trajectories, and it does have a chilling effect. And we've certainly seen that some of these standardized instruments have enormous ability to treat people differentially in ways that we're not happy about. And so what I would suggest is that any of the mechanisms that we're seeing in these examples are something very important for equity. They're enabling students to see a higher education sequence as part of their trajectory relatively early on in their high school sequence, and they're able to make that differentiation of a two-year or a four-year institution later on. But what it does do is it keeps these roads open and seems to indicate and suggest that the systems are putting up fewer barriers and more supports. And it is those barriers without the supports that have been the stifling equity concern. And I would commend each of the presenters for, in one way or another, signaling a way to keep access open and to serve students who have been disenfranchised from higher education options, and would like to continue to explore this.
Well, thank you, Neil. You know, we have more questions, and we had just several come in the last couple minutes that I'm afraid we won't have time to get to, but I will try to send the questions to the panelists and send out some answers if we get. And I want to thank our panelists for a very rich discussion. I hope you'll agree that the efforts we discussed and the evidence we're looking at are going to help move the field toward knowing more about how we can set students up for success in college. To get the full picture of the changes we need, since this was one slice, please take a look at the Quantitative Leaf Policy Brief, as well as the first three webinars in the series, if you missed those. Those webinars are posted on the websites of the Opportunity Institutes, as well as LearningWorks. And this fourth and final one will be posted also in the next couple of days. I want to thank our two hosts, organizations, as well as the James Irvine and College Futures Foundations, whose funding made the webinars possible. And I want to thank you for joining us. If you have any comments on this webinar or any webinars in the series, I encourage you to send them along. I'm happy to hear from them. This is the last webinar in the series, but it is not the end of our work on math readiness at the Opportunity Institute and LearningWorks. We hope all of you continue your work on student success and that these webinars have been supportive to your efforts, and that we will learn about more good work and more good research coming from all of you in the near future. Thank you again for joining us.